Net neutrality, internet privacy, and rent control. Today on Insight, we'll explore these controversial topics that have become the target of much political wrangling by state lawmakers. Ben Adler joins us for this week's Capital Chat. Chef, author, and TV host Anthony Bourdain inspired many in the restaurant industry. How one Sacramento restaurant is honoring him by raising awareness about suicide. Stories on Stage Sacramento presents readings from the latest work by Kirsten Chen tonight. The novel, Bury What We Cannot Take, follows a family escaping early Maoist China. And the 17th annual Sacramento French Film Festival returns this weekend with comedies, dramas, short films, and more. The festival director and one of the filmmakers give us a sneak peek. I'm Pamela Wu, in for Beth Ruyak. That's today on Insight. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Pamela Wu, in for Beth Ruyak. Set to appear on the ballot this November is an initiative to give Californians new privacy rights when using the internet, but not anymore. The wealthy backer of that initiative has just reached a deal with state lawmakers to tackle the problem legislatively, potentially avoiding a contentious and costly campaign fight. Meanwhile, another initiative on rent control will appear on the ballot after all. Cap Radio's Capital Bureau Chief Ben Adler joins us today to discuss these initiatives and the fate of net neutrality in this week's Capital Chat. Good morning, Ben.
Good morning.
A lot to talk about. Let's start with the internet privacy measure. An initiative to give Californians new privacy rights online won't go to the voters after all. What would this measure have done, and why aren't we going to see it on the ballot?
Well, first, an important clarification. It might not go to voters. It is at this point in the hands of opponents of this ballot measure, tech companies, business groups, who think the initiative is utterly far-reaching and just not good, and certainly not good for them and their bottom lines. So right now, this deal, which is in some respects a scaled-back version of the ballot measure, is a take-it-or-leave-it for opponents of this group. They can either live with this deal that was negotiated between the initiative's proponent, a San Francisco real estate developer named Alistair McTaggart, who spent millions of his own dollars gathering signatures to qualify this measure for the November ballot. So they can live with this deal that McTaggart negotiated with a couple of Democratic lawmakers, State Senator Bob Hertzberg and Assemblyman Ed Chow, or they can say, nope, we're going to take our chances this fall and hope that voters will reject the ballot measure. So we don't yet know what they're going to do. In fact, they probably don't know what they're going to do because this measure just went into print late last night on the legislature's website. So I'm sure that companies and lobbyists and experts have been spending the night and the early morning hours reviewing it. And I believe they're going to meet today and try to figure out what their response is going to be.
So it is still up in the air. Who are the parties on either side of this issue?
Well, like I said, you've got the supporters, the proponent is McTaggart, and then consumer privacy groups and consumer groups in general. I think a lot of Californians would say, look, we don't like how our data is being used online. I think you saw the backlash when Facebook had to go through its challenges and Mark Zuckerberg had to testify to Congress. On the other hand, the tech companies and business groups think that it's a fatally flawed measure, that it was written very sloppily. And I think maybe some of the effort to craft a legislative solution was to fix some of the issues that in the way that it was drafted, according to maybe opponents, but then also scale it back a little bit, maybe make it more palatable to opponents. Certainly not something they're going to like, but maybe it's something they can live with.
So how do the opponents then feel about this legislative alternative? Might they decide that they would rather take their chances with the voters in November?
Well, we'll have to see. I think that's exactly what they're trying to figure out.
All right. Meanwhile, a deal to keep the much-discussed rent control measure was not able to avoid being on the ballot. What's the latest on this topic?
Well, what we reported yesterday and this morning, which I don't believe was previously known, is that there were negotiations of a similar nature to the privacy initiative. In fact, with one of the same lawmakers, Senator Hertzberg, intended to potentially reach a deal and avoid this costly ballot fight over rent control. So let's just start at the beginning. There's a law on the books in California called Costa-Hawkins, and that law limits local governments from having rent control. It basically says from when this law went into effect a couple decades ago that cities can't have new rent control ordinances on the books and can't have rent control on properties that were built after that. So in some cities like Oakland or San Francisco, maybe Los Angeles, where there are older properties that are subject to rent control, that's where rent control still exists, but not on the newer properties. So the effort, a measure is qualified for the November ballot to repeal Costa-Hawkins. In other words, it would then be up to local governments each individually to decide whether to increase rent control or create rent control for cities, counties that, don't currently have it. There's a lot of opposition to that from not just business groups. Even some housing groups think it's a bad idea. They think it would affect some supply. Tenant groups are strongly in favor of it. And an activist named Michael Weinstein from Los Angeles, who runs the AIDS Healthcare Foundation, bankrolled this measure. And that is why right now it's set for the November ballot. That said, Weinstein had a team of policy folks and lobbyists negotiating with the California Apartment Association and moderated by Senator Hertzberg the last couple of weeks in May. And they were looking at a couple of issues that, maybe they could reach some agreement on and avoid a rent control ballot measure. That agreement fell through, or those negotiations fell through. There never was an agreement. And so we do expect, in fact, I think it's pretty much set in stone at this point, that rent control will be on the November ballot.
I'm talking with our Capital Bureau Chief, Ben Adler, in this week's Capital Chat segment. Ben, let's talk about net neutrality now, the topic of some real political maneuvering at the Capitol. And I think we should engage in some explanatory journalism first. What is net neutrality?
See, and then this is where it gets a little tricky for me because I'm up to date on the politics on this measure, but less so on the policy. But net neutrality has gotten a lot of attention. It was a set of regulations dealing with the internet and whether providers can slow down access to some parts of the internet for some people as opposed to others. That was created during the regulations created during the Obama administration. The Trump administration's Federal Communications Commission, FCC, rolled them back. And so there's this effort in California to come up with net neutrality here. So that measure passed the Senate in two different bills and came to an assembly committee, the Assembly Communications and Conveyance Committee, on Wednesday. And man, it was a sight to see. It's not often that a bill gets, I guess the word in legislative speak is hijacked the way that bill got on Wednesday.
So I understand that State Senator Scott Wiener introduced that bill in the legislature to protect net neutrality, or one of the bills, and that in a rather unusual development, or a hijacking development, as you would say, the Wiener bill was changed a great deal by Assemblymember Miguel Santiago of Los Angeles, and that's before it was discussed in the committee. Can you tell us what happened there?
So Santiago is the committee chair, and he and Wiener had been negotiating up until that committee hearing. They weren't able to reach a deal, and so Santiago and his committee put out some amendments to the bill the night before the committee hearing. And those were amendments on issues that AT&T, for example, was interested in seeing. Santiago says, and by the way, I should say that the phrase net neutrality may mean different things to different people. Santiago insists that the regulations that he was coming up with were intended to mirror the 2015 Obama-era regulations. Wiener believes that the regulation or the amendments that Santiago put forward gut and, in his words, eviscerate his bill. And so there was a showdown at this committee. Santiago muscled through the amendments to the bill, the hostile amendments that Wiener did not want or accept, before the hearing, or as the hearing began, before the bill came up for debate and before witnesses testified. And that's not usual, although Santiago, in a lengthy statement released just a few minutes ago, pointed out that oftentimes the process is for amendments to be taken before the hearing on a bill begins. I think that's when the amendments are accepted by the author. So in this case, they weren't accepted. Santiago called for the vote. A committee chair often gets committee members to vote the way the committee chair wants. It's kind of an unwritten rule and also has to do with the fact that, the committee chair has staff and committee members often aren't able to devote the amount of time to bills that committee chairs can. So there's a fair amount of trust that happens there. And then there was this showdown for a good, I think, hour or so between supporters of the Wiener bill and opponents of the Wiener bill. I don't say supporters of net neutrality and opponents of net neutrality, because I think there would be some, again, net neutrality is in the eye of the beholder. So supporters and opponents of Wiener's bill. In the end, Wiener tried to withdraw his bill, but the committee passed it anyway with the amendments and kept it moving. It has another committee hearing next week in the Assembly. But since then, there's been several attempts at reconciliation. Wiener and Santiago have met and talked. California Democratic Party Chair Eric Bauman released a statement yesterday saying they'd agreed to keep the conversation going and move forward. And Santiago and other members on the committee made the point, look, we want to keep, we want a net neutrality bill. And even if, Scott Wiener, you don't want to move your bill forward, we want to move it forward because we think this is too important not to have. So a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff going on, a showdown publicly, and the next thing that we will see from it comes at a committee hearing next week.
So you mentioned AT&T, and of course, this telecom giant is very influential and supports the changes. What does AT&T stand to gain from such amendments?
So Ben Bradford, our colleague on the state government beat, took a look at that in a story that we've posted at capradio.org and talks about what some of the amendments are. But one example that I'm able to get into a little bit of the policy on is zero rating. And so I happen to have an AT&T, I think it's called UVerse. So it's the opposite of Comcast's cable plan. And because I have AT&T for TV and internet, if I'm on my smartphone and I'm using the AT&T app to view my TV, it's data free. Even if I'm not on Wi-Fi, if I'm on just regular cellular data, it's not going to count toward my data charges. And that is zero rating. And this bill would, I believe, prohibit AT&T and other providers from doing that.
Mm. Now, I know that these amendments that we've been discussing are referred to as hostile amendments. And there have been notable instances of hostile amendments in the recent past upon which you've reported.
Yeah. So a couple that came to mind, which I wrote about in that same story that Ben Bradford and I put up at capradio.org, is there is an effort from the tobacco industry to kill off a bill that would have regulated e-cigarettes like other tobacco products. And that measure had passed the Senate. It was, I think, 2015. And it came to the Assembly Governmental Organization Committee. And the chairman of that committee, Assemblyman Adam Gray of Merced, put forth some amendments that in Leno's mind, basically, eviscerated the bill. In fact, let me see if I can pull this up. This is Leno at the time as his bill had those amendments, and here's how he reacted to it.
I no longer believe in it. None of my sponsors believe in it. The long list of folks I shared with you before you took your vote no longer believe in it. And so I urge your no vote, but I cannot support it any longer. I disassociate myself from it. It's a very dangerous bill now.
That bill did not move forward. Unlike this week with net neutrality, the committee listened to Leno, and Leno said, I don't support my bill, so they voted no, and the bill stopped moving. But the supporters of the bill had the last laugh, because that measure became part of a package of anti-tobacco bills that passed the legislature during a special session on health care early the following year, and Jerry Brown signed it. And so that was a temporary, short-lived victory for the tobacco industry. And then one other example to share, also a short-lived victory for a big industry that opposed a measure, was when pharma succeeded in hostile amending a bill, a drug price transparency bill, in the Assembly Appropriations Committee. I think that was 2016. And that measure was basically changed so much that the author didn't really know what his bill did anymore immediately after the fact, and took days to figure out what it did, and then decided not to move it forward. Well, he moved a similar bill forward the next year, and it did become law. And so we'll see if AT&T and the telecom industry has better luck with net neutrality after its successful bid in the Assembly Committee this week than the tobacco and pharmaceutical industries had in their efforts.
Really an incredible amount of intrigue happening right now at the Capitol, Ben.
It's just another week, right? We just finished, we've almost just finished the state budget. There's still a couple of budget bills hanging around that are going to eventually move, I guess. But yeah, and we just got through the primary election. Legislature goes on recess in a couple of weeks. I think we're all ready.
Will you get a break then?
Maybe.
We'll talk to the boss about that. That's Capitol Bureau Chief Ben Adler. Ben, thanks for joining us for this week's Capitol Chat segment on Insight.
Anytime.
We have complete political coverage on our website at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Capitol Public Radio. You are listening to Insight. I'm Pamela Wu in for Beth Ruyak. The recent suicide of chef and author Anthony Bourdain sent shockwaves through the restaurant industry, and Sacramento's community of restaurateurs and chefs felt his loss greatly. In Bourdain's honor, the bartenders at Sacramento Restaurant Crew have committed to donating the tips from their weekly late-night service during the month of June to the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. The restaurant's owners have agreed to match every dollar donated to the cause. Joining us today to talk about the fundraiser are bar manager Nick Amano Dolan, chef Billy No, and partner Kimio Bazett from Crew Restaurant. Welcome, all of you, to Insight.
Thank you. Thank you.
Now, before Anthony Bourdain had a show on CNN, he had one on the Travel Channel that was titled No Reservations, and that's the name of your after-hours weekend happy hour, but spelled NGO, like Chef Billy's last name. Whose idea was this event, and how did Bourdain inspire it?
So it was kind of a team. It was a kind of a team effort. One of our other bartenders, it was a late night, and we were talking about the event, and in sitting down and talking with the entire group, we just knew that we wanted to kind of have the same sort of spirit in terms of Japanese soul food and just kind of more of an industry guided event. And so, really, it was a whole team effort to come up with the idea. But Bourdain was definitely a big inspiration for the energy that it was going to hopefully bring.
What was the reaction among the three of you when you learned of Bourdain's death? And Nick, let's start with you.
Well, I know the three of us weren't together, but for me personally, it was a surreal moment. I got a text from my head bartender saying what had happened. Immediately looked on social media and saw the different posts and everything. And so it felt surreal. And as the week went on, it sort of hit me in different ways. But I know that definitely doing the event and having everyone being able to be there and talk and be a little more open about it definitely helped with the whole process.
Kimio, how about you? Your reaction?
Hopefully this doesn't seem dramatic, but it kind of felt like I lost a friend. You know, I was going through emails and a Rolling Stone email popped up and there's disbelief. I thought it was like a prank almost at first. And then I'm like, oh, wow, it's nothing you ever would have suspected. You know, the guy was on top of the world.
You said he felt like a friend. What made you feel close to him?
You know, I've said this before, but he kind of had this everyman sort of sensibility to him, you know? It's a guy we would have hung out with, you know? He drank and he did jiu-jitsu. Billy's into jiu-jitsu, and Nick's a martial arts guy. He just was just a normal guy, you know? And I read his books and had a very, such a familiar and casual but clever style of communication, you know.
Chef Billy No, how about you?
Yeah, just shocked, just like what Kimio was saying, you know, like the everyman's sensibility. You feel really a relatable person. So it's just a shock with him being on top of the world, doing everything, like seemed like a really strong dude, and all of a sudden, like, it's just shock.
Yeah. Now, you've decided to mourn in a way that helps others. Kimio, tell us about the No Reservations fundraiser and how does that work?
So it was all Nick's idea, honestly. My initial thought after some of the shock wore off that morning was we should do something, but I hadn't really fleshed it out.
Yeah, it was really quick. I think it was in the afternoon. Nick
called
and sent us a text, and what do you guys think about this? We're like, that's dope, let's do it. So we started that night. It was Friday.
So, well, you could describe that.
Yeah, Nick, what made you think of it?
It happened very organically. I think I thought of it kind of in through the text. I just wanted to start a conversation and saying, hey, let's do something. And so after texting Kimio, Bill, calling those guys and just saying, hey, let's do something, the idea just kind of formed itself along with their input as well. So yeah, just super, super organic. It happened really, really fast. And, you know, kind of as even the first event went, we were adjusting it and changing it. And then the idea for bringing in other people came in. Crew is going to match all the donations. So it's something that has just happened really, really quickly. But I'm definitely excited about the direction that it went in and how it all formed.
He's being modest. I mean, this guy's, how old are you?
25,
and this is how he makes a living, and to donate and get his guys to be gladly donate all their tips, late at night anyway. I mean, that's pretty significant, you know, pretty selfless.
Yeah, so. That's the first thing he said when he called or texted. He was like, we want to do something, so we're just going to donate all our tips. And I was like, oh.
Are you sure? Yeah, pretty impressive. We're proud of this guy.
Nick, how much has been raised so far?
We've done about $2,500 so far. Yeah, and so two more weekends to go. And I think after this event, hopefully, it's inspired a lot of my bartenders now who are talking to me, asking me what are we going to keep doing moving forward, which is awesome. I think that's the best thing that can come about all of this, is that it's not just an event. It's not just one month and we remember and then we forget until the next tragedy happens. Hopefully, something like this, at least in our industry, it's something to keep the conversation going. And so hopefully we keep moving forward and adding more to what we can donate and what we can help out with.
I'm talking with the management of Sacramento's Crew Restaurant, bar manager Nick Amano-Dolan, chef Billy No, and partner Kimio Bazett. Throughout the month of June, the restaurant will donate tips from its late night happy hour to the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline in honor of the late chef Anthony Bourdain. The three of you are talking about continuing this conversation, and the restaurant industry is known for being tough. The kitchen culture in particular is tough. The hours are weird. There's a lot of pressure. Can you talk about mental health as an issue in the restaurant industry?
Wow. Yeah. We're actually having in conjunction with the mayor's office and Mulvaney's on Monday with a group of industry folks, and Patrick spearheaded the whole thing. Kind of a mental health first aid sort of clinic, I guess you could say, because it is so prevalent. I don't know if it's the stress and the hours, like you mentioned. You know, substance abuse seems to go hand in hand for a lot of people. It's a difficult business at best, you know, and there's definitely a culture of going out with your colleagues after work and drinking, and for some people, drugs. I mean, not us, but and it takes over pretty quickly. So addiction, I think, is a component of that. And it's time to talk about it and time to sort of create change.
Billy, I see you nodding along. What are your thoughts about these efforts to move forward and destigmatize mental health issues, especially in the light of Bourdain's death?
Oh, yeah, definitely agree. You know, it needs to be more open for people to talk about it. You know, just like this whole stigma of this culture, the chefs are, you know, like work hard, party hard, and, you know, not talking about their feelings. But, you know, it's been a crazy year in the industry. I think we've lost a few friends to this, and all of a sudden with Bourdain, you know, really hits.
Yeah. Nick, you're younger, as Kimio pointed out. You're 25. Mm-hmm. You're beginning your career. What are your thoughts about mental health issues in the restaurant industry?
Well, it's interesting because I think that the restaurant industry kind of draws in the eccentric personalities of the people that didn't want to be behind a desk 9 to 5 and whatnot. And so with that, you get these people that are really energetic, really, really good with people and want to be out in the open, but also a lot of times the same type of people that are struggling with their own demons inside of their head. So I think it's a combination kind of the type of people initially that the restaurant industry attracts, and then also the lifestyles and whatnot that these guys were talking about that goes forward. So for me, I think I've found a big enjoyment in terms of trying to find the balance in it. You know, we have some guys that work at Crew that are really, really healthy, and I think opposite to the norm in terms of they start their day off by going to Pipeworks and go climbing, or they go to Asha and float. And I think hopefully these actions and these events and whatnot lead to more balance with that. And I know that, you know, like Kimio said in talking with the mayor, I know the Sacramento Bartenders Guild, health, mental health, and just healthy lifestyles in general is the biggest focus right now. So hopefully that keeps happening.
I'll pose this question to all three of you, our last question, and I'll start with you, Billy. What do you think will be Anthony Bourdain's lasting legacy?
Hmm. Can I not go first?
Sure. Why don't we go? I'll give you a moment to think about that. Let's go to Kimia.
I think it probably transcends, you know, food, and hopefully it's not just suicide, although if that gets a conversation going about that, then that's not a bad thing either, unfortunately. Probably unity and travel and exploration, but really unity. You know, I mean, the food ended up being the common denominator, but you think about it, you know, a formerly working chef that from New York eating noodles in Vietnam with the president of the United States, and it's like, you know, it all gets, seems a little smaller, but also bigger. And I think that he taught us to get out there and meet new people and see the world and realize it's not, doesn't have to be scary or anything like that. You know, it's just food and it's just people.
Yeah, there's so much connectedness.
Absolutely.
There. Nick?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I think it's really, really interesting in terms of the full spectrum of the lesson that he taught. I think to the general public, he kind of showed everyone that the restaurant industry and all of that is cool. And then I think towards the end, he's now kind of shown us as well that it is difficult as well. So that's the one of the biggest things that I'll remember him is just kind of the full circle of that, of showing how interesting and exciting this industry can be, but how difficult and stressful it can be as well. Yeah, I think the biggest impact, though, is really just how food transcends culture. And through eating someone's dish, you can really learn about who they are as a person, who they are as people, and can really connect people through that. So I think that's a great, great lesson he's left behind.
And Billy, now you've had some time to think about this now.
I'd say it's still his food, you know. It's just food. Food brings people together, and it's not about, like, crazy fancy meals or anything. It's just good food. Like, he loved sitting down in those little tiny chairs, eating a bowl of noodles, yeah, just as much as a $500 omakase. You know, it's just about, you know, trying new things. Go out and try new dishes. Go travel. That's the lasting legacy, I think.
Crew holds its late night happy hours called No Reservations on Fridays and Saturdays from 10 p.m. until 2 a.m. with tips throughout the month of June going to suicide prevention. Crew is located in East Sacramento. Bar manager Nick Amano-Dolan, Chef Billy No, and partner Kimio Bassett, thanks to the three of you for being on Insight.
Thanks for having us.
We have much more on our website at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Capital Public Radio. You're listening to Insight. I'm Pamela Wu in for Beth Ruyak. The 17th annual Sacramento French Film Festival began last week and continues through this weekend at the Crest Theater. The festival features dramas, comedies, documentaries, and short films celebrating the best in contemporary French cinema. This year's event also features the U.S. premiere of the film Gaspard at the Wedding. We are joined in the studio by the festival's executive and artistic director, Cécile Mouette-Downs, and Guillaume Caramel, the director of the short film titled One Night. Welcome both of you to Insight.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Cécile, let's start with you. Tell us about the lineup of films this weekend.
So we're showing 10 different films. One is a classic by Jean-Luc Godard called Contempt. All the other films are the newest French films, and we're particularly excited to have the U.S. premiere of Gaspard at the Wedding presented on Saturday at about 6:10, I think. And this is a really, really interesting film. It's a comedy, it's a drama, it's all French films put in one. And we are very excited because we have the director director, Anthony Cordier, of the film, who will be here. He didn't want to come today because his English is not good enough, but I really, really encourage you to come. It's very interesting to come and listen to him and watch his film.
That's wonderful that he'll be appearing. Yeah. You mentioned that it's the U.S. premiere. Yeah. Why is that so meaningful to the Sacramento French Film Festival?
Well, it's meaningful because, there is a big rivalry between French cinema and American cinema, and a love and hate relationship. And for a French filmmaker to be to have his film presented in the United States, it's a very, very big deal. So, yes, it's important for us to know that nobody else, you know, in the U.S. was able to see the film in a theater, only in Sacramento.
Gaspard at the Wedding is going to be shown tomorrow at 6:10 p.m. Yes. It will include a Q&A with the filmmaker, Anthony Cordier, and I'll read a short description. Gaspard is on his way to his father's wedding. He has kept his distance from his family for a while and is not thrilled to make the trip. On the train, he meets Laura, an eccentric young woman who agrees to accompany him as his pretend girlfriend. What can go wrong, right? With her beside him, he feels ready to set foot again in the zoo owned by his very peculiar family. That's a literal zoo, by the way. What more can you tell us about this film?
Well, it's a film about, coming back together as a family, but also letting go of your childhood, letting go of, you're not, you have to live your own life, and all the siblings have to go and live their own life. And it's kind of the lesson that you get from the film. It's a very, very funny film, and I don't want to say more, except that the family is itself a zoo.
It's a zoo. It's a literal and figurative zoo. We have a clip from the trailer. Let's take a listen.
Je peux embrasser la mariée.
Voilà, c'est Laura.
Bonjour. Il y a un caribou qui vient de naître. Il a deux têtes. Tu le vois?
Ok, ouais.
C'est horrible.
T'es avec elle depuis longtemps?
Assez, ouais.
Tu te rends compte de la chance que t'as eue, quand même? Grandir dans un zoo.
That's a clip from the trailer for Gaspard at the Wedding, one of the many films being shown at the Sacramento French Film Festival. Cécile, I don't understand French. What did we just hear?
So we just hear him say to his brother that, yes, he's been together with this girl for a very, very long time.
The one he just met on the train.
The one he just met on the train, among other things. And I want to say that you do not need to speak French, obviously, to attend the festival. There are English subtitles. And even if you're a little worried about subtitles, that you're not used to it, you're so taken by the films that after 5 minutes, you'll totally forget you're reading.
I am talking with the French Film Festival's executive and artistic director, Cécile Mouette-Downs, and Guillaume Caramel, the director of the short film titled One Night. Guillaume, I understand that One Night is your third and latest film. Please tell us about it.
Absolutely, it's my third short movies, and this movie is about sexual loneliness, disability, young prostitution. So it can appear like a really heavy movie, but I wanted to create something like a tender atmosphere about that, not make a really harsh movie or really hard. And so this is kind of it's with a lot of tender, very sweet. It's really short. It's my shorter one, but it's also maybe the one I'm the most proud about.
Just you mentioned, you said it's short. How short is this short film?
It's a 3 minutes movie, and actually my first one was 36 minutes. The second one was 15 minutes. This one is 3 minutes, and I realized that it's really hard to do a good short movie. I mean, really short, to tell a story with big lines, with big stakes. Is that correct? Stakes.
Yes, what is S-T-A-K-E-S, that? Yes.
Yeah, and to do it short. So, yeah.
Well, I was just going to say, three minutes. I mean, you know, we here at Capital Public Radio work in broadcasting, right? And so we know shorter is harder than longer.
It's really hard. I'm sure it's really hard to do a feature-length movie.
And short is challenging in its own ways.
Yeah, it's a different challenge. I mean, you have to compass your story. What is really interesting about short movies is that you have to go to the biggest aim from the beginning. You realize that every second is important. You cannot waste a minute You know, every second, every minute, every emotion has to be mastered.
One Night is going to be shown on Sunday night, which is closing night. And Guillaume, what do you hope audiences take away from it?
I hope the audience will enjoy. I have to say that I'm really proud and honored and blissful to be here. Thanks for the invitation, Cécile. And this is a great honor because Jusqu'à la Garde, the movie which will be screened Sunday night, is really, really great movie. So it's such great movies as well, the other movies screened during this festival. So I hope the audience will enjoy. Yeah, of course.
And Cécile, 17 years. How does it feel to have the film festival enter its 17th year? Old! Old but good, right?
Yeah, no, it feels... I don't know why this year particularly, actually. Yeah, 17 years. It's a very long time, and I'm very grateful that Sacramento still loves us after 17 years.
Well, I feel like congratulations are
in
order.
And, you know, we have people coming from a lot of places. We even had, for the first time, people flying from Los Angeles to attend a festival last weekend. So we are very proud of that.
That sounds wonderful. The Sacramento Film Festival continues through Sunday at the Crest Theater, and we have event and ticket information on our website, capradio.org/insight. Cécile Mouette-Downs, congratulations on the 17th year. And filmmaker Guillaume Caramel, congratulations on your film being screened.
Thank you.
You are listening to Insight on your NPR station, Capital Public Radio. You're listening to Insight. I'm Pamela Wu in for Beth Ruyak. The new book, Bury What We Cannot Take, is set in the complicated and frightening early years of the Maoist regime. It's the second novel by Kirsten Chen, a native of Singapore who now lives in San Francisco. Praise for the book has been laudatory across the board, with critics calling it achingly beautiful, powerful, and captivating. Tonight, Bury What We Cannot Take is featured at Stories on Stage Sacramento, where actors perform works in literary fiction. Author Kirsten Chen joins us in the studio to discuss the new novel. Kirsten, welcome to Insight.
Thanks so much for having me.
How did you come up with the premise of the novel, Bury What We Cannot Take?
The premise for this novel was an absolute gift, and it's the only time this has ever happened to me. I actually went out to dinner with a very dear college friend of mine way back in 2010, and this was before I was even thinking about my second book because I was still working on my first novel. And he told me a story about his own family that was just unforgettable. And at the time, again, like I said, I wasn't working on a novel. But about 6 months later, when the time finally came to start thinking about my second book, that story just immediately came back to mind. And maybe I'd been thinking about it subconsciously for all those months. I know you've read the book, but his father, my friend's father, was the little boy who saw his grandmother hammer the portrait of Chairman Mao, and his aunt was the little girl who was left behind. And so it was just an unforgettable premise.
Now, for those who aren't familiar with it, who haven't read it, can you sort of summarize for us or just set the stage for us what it's about?
Yeah, absolutely. And so, like I said, the novel is set in 1957 on a tiny island off the coast of southern China. And when the novel opens, a brother and a sister witness their grandmother defacing the portrait of Chairman Mao with a hammer. The family gets in trouble and has to flee very quickly to Hong Kong. But when the mother of the family goes to get the necessary exit permits, she's told to leave one of her children behind as proof of the family's intention to return.
Really, an incredibly, of course, difficult choice. What kind of research did you do to make the setting feel so authentic? It's so vibrant, and you really feel what the characters are feeling and what the environment is like.
Thank you so much. I did a lot of research. I read very broadly. I watched a lot of films. I took a couple trips to Gulangi, or Drumwave Islet, which is the setting of the novel. And then I also very fortuitously had a close family member, an aunt, who knew that setting and the time period firsthand. And so the information that she was able to give me was really, really played an invaluable role.
Excerpts from the novel are going to be performed tonight at Stories on Stage Sacramento. We have a clip to preview the event. This is Sacramento State Theater student Justin Lee performing an opening passage from Kirsten Chen's new novel, Bury What We Cannot Take.
Her brother was pinching out the chocolate eclair from the pink pastry box when they heard the crash of shattering glass. Sansan's hands clapped over her ears as though compelled by some outside force. The eclair landed on the table with a soft splat. Mui Ah appeared in the kitchen doorway with Cook close behind her. "I'll go check," her brother said, pushing back his chair. "You stay here." Sansan pushed back her chair too. 12 years old to her 9, her brother was constantly forbidding her from going places with him and his friends. Sometimes when he was particularly grumpy, he made her follow several paces behind when they walked home from school. This time, however, she wouldn't let him bully her. She stood and squared her shoulders, and he scowled, but said no more. They tiptoed out of the dining room, through the empty drawing room, and stopped before the study. The sliding door had been pulled almost shut, though not all the way. Inside the room, something thudded to the floor. Her brother held his finger over his lips, and Sansan pulled a face. What did he expect her to do? Burst into song? He planted himself before the sliver of space between door and wall, blocking her view. Her nose was running. Her grandma scolded her for always catching cold as if it were something she could control, and she wiped her nostrils on her sleeve so she wouldn't have to sniffle. She tugged on the back pocket of her brother's uniform trousers, and at last, he stepped aside. Sansan held back a gasp. On the opposite end of the room, Grandma knelt before the framed photo of Grandpa on the family altar, her face buried in her hands to muffle her sobs. And then Sansan noticed the shards of glass strewn about the dark walnut floor. The claw and long wooden handle of the hammer partially hidden by Grandma's skirt. Above Grandpa's portrait, in the very center of the wall, the chairman's gleaming face continued to preside over the room, smiling benevolently at all who gazed upon him, oblivious to the spider web of cracks that scarred him. Sansan's fingers brushed the door handle, and then she pulled back her hand. She turned to her brother, but his face was pale, his eyes clouded with worry. He dragged her back to the dining room. "You're hurting me," she said. When he let go, she saw that his fingertips had left red spots on her skin. She winced dramatically and massaged her forearm. "Sorry," he said quietly. Even though he no longer had to whisper, he leaned in close. "I need you, please, for once, to listen to me." Sansan stopped rubbing her arm. "You didn't see anything. Neither of us did. Is that clear?" Sansan nodded. "Nothing at all." She nodded again. "We came home from school, and they told us Grandma was resting in her room, and we had our afternoon tea as usual." "All right," Sansan said, annoyed. Mui Ah came out with a broom and dustpan. "Does Grandma need help?" In unison, Sansan and her brother shouted, "No!" Mui Ah narrowed her eyes. "Leave her alone," her brother said. "She'll call if she needs help."
That was Justin Lee, actor Justin Lee, performing a scene from Kirsten Chen's new novel, Bury What We Cannot Take. Author Kirsten Chen is with us in the studio right now. What was that like for you to hear that?
It's always such a pleasure to hear actors read your work. You know, I had the same experience when I listened to the audiobook. You know, it's just writers can try very, very hard to work very hard at reading their own work, but we're just not professionals and we just don't give it the same flair that actors do.
You know what's striking to me listening to that? I mean, I was following along in my copy of the book. That's on like page 4 or 5. And so the event that sets the whole chain of events for the rest of the book into motion happens very early on. It's very striking. Mm-hmm. What made you decide to put that really pivotal scene right at the start?
I think it was clear from the very beginning that that had to happen right away. Because like you said, that is the one event that kind of sets in motion everything else. And, you know, what I've learned from writing novels is you have to captivate the audience. You have to capture the audience from the beginning. Why save the sort of best moment to later in the book?
I picked it up. I started reading it, and by page four was, whoa, this is really happening. So mission accomplished. What lessons did you learn from working on your first novel, Soy Sauce for Beginners, that helped you with this one?
Oh, that's a good question. They're very, very different books because the first novel, Soy Sauce for Beginners, is set in contemporary Singapore, which is where I was born and raised, and so it really didn't require the same level of research. The protagonist is a young Singaporean woman who shares several surface-level characteristics with me, the author. And so for that reason as well, I didn't have to dig as deep to kind of find the emotional resonance of the book. But that being said, I did take away a lot of lessons. And I think the biggest one was just stamina. You know, it took me 6 years to write and publish that first book and countless revisions, at least 10 drafts. And so I think that I really built my work ethic through that time, and I really honed my writing process, and those are the things that I was able to carry into my second book.
Speaking of those lessons, in the acknowledgments, you thank the celebrated author Michael Chabon for a little writing tip that he included in one of his novels.
Yes.
What advice did you borrow from him?
Oh, gosh. Yeah, Michael Chabon. Wonderful writer, obviously.
Yes.
I mean, I think that one of the biggest challenges for this book, Bury What We Cannot Take, was the research. And doing enough research so that I felt that I had the authority to capture this very complicated time period and this distant setting that I didn't know firsthand. And so I think that I had a lot of insecurities going into writing the book. But when I read Michael Chabon's author's note of his wonderful novel, The Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, I saw that he wrote this little, just this single sentence in his author's note that said, do you have the note, by the way, if you want to... I can read it exactly so that I don't butcher.
Yeah, well, let me hand over my
copy
of the book.
So that I don't butcher the quote because he says it so well. So this is the line that Michael Chabon writes. He says, "I have tried to respect history and geography wherever doing so served my purposes as a novelist, but wherever it did not, I have, cheerfully or with regret, ignored them." And that was such an incredibly freeing thing to read.
How liberating.
Exactly. But it was also a reminder that, you know, we're writing historical fiction. We're not writing historical history books. And it's kind of a different skill set, and there's a different goal. At the end of the day, you have to be able to tell a good story.
What do you hope readers will come away with after reading Bury What We Cannot Take?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting question, I think, especially because of how our political climate has changed in the last couple of years and even in the last couple of months and weeks. And so, you know, this is a book about refugees. It's a book about the ways in which borders tear families apart. And I think that one of the really powerful things about fiction is that it allows a reader to go very, very deeply into a character's head. And I think it's a lot harder to just dismiss a group of people if you're able to really understand and even empathize with their personal experiences. And so I think that's one thing that I hope readers take away from the book, just being able to think about refugees in a deeper way than just sort of statistics and numbers.
It's very humanizing.
I hope so.
Kirsten Chan's new novel, Bury What We Cannot Take, will be performed tonight at Stories on Stage Sacramento. That's happening at the Sacramento Poetry Center in Midtown tonight at 7 o'clock. We have event and ticket information on our website at capradio.org/insight. Kirsten Chan, congratulations on the new book, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's wonderful.
That's Insight for today. I'm Pamela Wu in for Beth Ruyak. Insight is produced by Jen Picard, Bert Johnson, and Cody Drabble. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Casey Gardner, and Emily Zentner. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Our theme music was composed by Joe Gilman and Paul Conley. Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. We are back with another live show on Monday. Thank you for joining us. Thank you.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.